Welcome to episode 36 of Teachers Lift. This is our last episode before we go on summer hiatus, so we've made it a good one today. In this episode, we're chatting with Miss Melinda Wong, who's leading the operation over at the Center for Language Education at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. We got a bit greedy with our ambition this week, and our host Levi Lam is going to be chatting with Melinda about two major areas she's been spearheading during her time at HKUST: scholarship and competency-based assessment. It's a really interesting show, so I'll turn it over to Levi and Melinda. Enjoy your time and have a good show, everybody.
I'm very excited for today's very special episode. Of course, all of the Teachers Lift shows are special, but today is really, really special because our guest is the actual director of the Center for Language Education right here at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. She's also Associate Dean for the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, also co-editor of a fairly recently published book that she just handed to me, entitled What is Good Academic Writing? Insights into Discipline-Specific Student Writing. Of course, I am talking about Dr. Melinda Wong, who is here today, and really, we are thrilled. Welcome, Melinda.
Thank you, Levi. It's great to be here.
Again, thank you so much for being here. You've been with the CLE for...
2 years and a month.
2 years and a month. And I'm sure it's been just smooth sailing.
Quite a 2 years
right,
and a month.
Right. You chose your timing well, but here you are. And here we are, and our center has persevered. And we certainly haven't compromised our ambition to develop and improve, right? And two of the initiatives that you've been spearheading as art director include the introduction of scholarship and a transition to a competency-based assessment framework. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Excellent.
All right. It's two really, really important, interesting topics. So let's get to it.
Great to be here, really. Thanks, Levi.
All right. We'll start with scholarship. And many of these ideas came from a former colleague of yours, Dr. Alex Ding from the University of Leeds.
That's right. We worked really closely together before I came.
And in preparing for this show, I took the liberty of watching a sharing forum that he held that you were a participant in. So a lot of the principles of scholarship come from that. And one of the most important ideas is that scholarship is a collaborative process. Mm. How do you see that sort of playing out at our center?
To me, it's essential to scholarship, right? But it's also essential to how we work. And I see it sort of as a natural combination, because when I look around our center, and actually this seems to be the nature of language education and language centers, almost everything we do is team taught. We create these large courses, sometimes really large courses, right? And of course, we go in our classroom when we teach our own class. But by definition, the whole thing is done by teams. So to me, given that, and then the definition of scholarship for me is that it starts and finishes in the classroom. So if scholarship is because it's some question you've had or something you're trying to figure out in the classroom, and you're trying to explore that and make more sense of it, surely anything you find is then, by definition, useful to everybody else teaching on that course. So to me, collaboration and scholarship, they just go hand in hand. I have trouble seeing how they wouldn't go hand in hand.
Mm, that's an interesting point that you made about finishing in the classroom. Mm. And I think that might be one of the things that distinguishes scholarship from what we might often identify as research, right? There's a practical application to whatever it is that we're exploring.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I often bristle at the word research. Mm-hmm. And it's not because I have anything against research, mm-hmm. but it's trying to reorient, because the whole idea of scholarship is that you're doing something because of teaching. So research could be about teaching, mm-hmm. but oftentimes research is about theory. It's about all sorts of things. But to be scholarship is about a language teaching and learning question. And so by definition, it's going to be different from research.
That leads me to another topic that I got from that sharing forum from Leeds University. There was this idea of knowledge blindness, that knowledge in of itself is a topic for study, and how that applies to our teaching of languages is that a lot of times the knowledge that we acquire as teachers aren't directly applicable to the teaching practices that we use in the classroom. Do you see that gap playing out similarly?
Yeah, you know, I So I should say here that almost probably everything I have to say is about language education, right? Because that's mm-hmm. what we do. So this idea of knowledge blindness, I think it's a really important insight and something for us to think about. I think in the CLE, the extent to which knowledge is content and content is associated with science or engineering or business, that seems to be the definition of knowledge in our center. When in fact, I think there's so much more to it. So when you think about EAP or teaching English for students, what is knowledge when you're teaching EAP? So if you look more broadly at EAP, the answer tends to be genre, academic literacies, right? But in our center, there's so much, because of the success our center has had with getting very integrated curriculum, credit-bearing curriculum, sometimes I think that the content side of it, as defined as the subject discipline, starts to overshadow that kind of thing. And then I think of other places for language education. So linguistics, which is my background, what is knowledge in linguistics? That's then often seen as grammar rules, which is then, you know, that's, you know, it's not that it's not true, but that's one very narrow alley.
Mm.
Yeah.
And there's some leeway for us at our center to be innovative in the way that we approach teaching, because we have small class sizes.
Mm.
We have a manageable number of students, at the most 18, maybe 20, so that there are different practices that we can integrate. Whereas if you're lecturing in a large lecture theater, maybe the way that you deliver information is a little bit stifled. It's a little bit like narrow. Right?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
Right. There's this other idea that who owns the scholarship? Because in order for scholarship to be impactful, it needs to be shared, right? So once it's shared, do I still own that scholarship, or is it's really the now the property of the person who has sort of exposed themselves to it and wants to integrate it or disregard it altogether.
Mm-mm.
So what do you think about this idea of ownership of scholarship?
You know, I think the whole concept of ownership in our domain and in this domain is troubling.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose, you know, what does it mean to own? By definition, if you own something, it's yours and not someone else's. So I think, I don't know, to me, scholarship is something... The point of it is that we're all, and the reason I like working in language education is that we're all genuinely committed to education and to students. So if you're genuinely committed to students and increasing their knowledge, increasing their ability, you do all sorts of things in addition to teaching. You try to stay up on your field. And so scholarship's about making sense, making better sense of what we're doing. And then when you do that, surely you want it to help or affect as many people as possible.
Mm.
So I don't know. Maybe I have the wrong definition of ownership, but if you own something, it doesn't make you necessarily, it means you have to lend it, or you have to, you know. So, yeah, so I don't know. I think ownership doesn't, I think it isn't useful, ownership. I think, in fact, I think it can hinder what we're trying to
right.
do.
Right, it might even minimize the impact of that scholarship.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right. Yeah, yeah.
That's an interesting idea, because that sort of like demystifies this notion of scholarship, because I think a lot of us, since it is a fairly new idea at our center, a lot of us equate it with something that's very rigorous, and it should be rigorous. Like, let's not sugarcoat it. It should be something that requires a degree of discipline and rigor. But I think a lot of us tend to associate this idea of scholarship more on what you mentioned earlier. It has to be some sort of really complicated theory or some sort of, you know, really esoteric kind of idea that only you are the expert in it. Where in fact, it's not, right? Where in fact, what it does, it simplifies what we do on a day-to-day basis, right? It informs how we can do our teaching, our students' learning in a more effective manner.
Yeah, you know, I think the reason why I'm such a fan and of scholarship is I think that especially everywhere I've worked at higher education, you get people who are, they're just intelligent, right? Mm-hmm. They're successful. They've made it. It's kind of the highest end of our field, right, to be teaching at university. So you get some really very capable people. And capable people ask questions and are curious and are always wanting to do new things and try new things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So to me, all scholarship is trying to formalize that and do it in a way that we can benefit a bit more collectively.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really see it as us doing anything. No. I'll change my mind. It is doing something differently because it's doing it in a more systematic, rigorous way. Because if you just have some idea, you know how it is. If you're at the pub and you have some idea and you think it's the most brilliant idea ever, right? And so you just like throw that idea out. Everyone recognizes it's an idea. But then if the next day you go into work and you start exploring it and you do a little bit of thinking behind it and think and reading behind it and do it more formally, it might actually be a very, very helpful idea. So it's trying to get people from the sort of, I don't know, maybe the pub's not the right analogy, in the staff room, the more appropriate analogy, taking that staff room brilliant idea and giving yourself time and space to work it out and see if it is really something worth sharing and then share it when it's worth sharing.
Right. And all of this sounds wonderful. Right. All of this sounds wonderful, but of course, there's the practical matter of actually applying it to what we do. Mm. So how do we develop this culture in our center of scholarship, whereas it's a fairly new idea. There is maybe even a palpable sense of resistance because some of us have just been teachers for a very, very long time. We're really good at what we do, and we might be a little bit intimidated by this idea of scholarship.
Sure. Yeah. It's one of these things that takes time. And I think the most important thing is that we all have patience, that we have patience with ourselves, with each other. And it's interesting because there's a real need to define it so people understand what they're being asked to do. But at the same time, I hesitate to define it. So I don't want to define it narrowly because then people feel like they have to follow a certain path. Yeah. So I don't know. It's about finding mechanisms to help people and let people see. It's just, some things won't happen until just people start to see in time how it's panning out.
But we also need to sort of get them engaged in doing it, right? It shouldn't just be something that they see as another tick in the box that they have to do every year.
Absolutely.
So how do we sort of develop that sense of engagement?
Well, I suppose that's one reason why we focused a lot when I first came in on the mechanisms, so the formal mechanisms, so that workload model that we spent some time developing and making it clear that people have time in their work week to do it. So I don't know, in an ideal world, everyone will see that for what it was meant to be, which is just genuine time. And so go and see what you can do with that time.
I think in some of the mechanisms that you've been developing, you've also allowed us to a variety of avenues to share scholarship, right? It doesn't really have to be this traditional, I go to some sort of educational forum or something, and then I give a talk on a paper or I publish something. Like, for instance, we're doing this podcast. Yeah. I mean, it's something that can be new and fresh. I understand that there is also a digital literacy project, right? That is that's an online platform for a variety of media to share scholarship. So I think that the other way to sort of make this notion of scholarship less intimidating is that there are options in how you share it. And some of those options might be much more conducive to your personality.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. And where you are in your career as well, right? So, I mean, we have to make allowances that some people have just finished maybe their training and this is their first proper job, if I can say it that way. Other people have been teaching for years and years and years. You know, you have to take people where they are. We're not all the same.
That is a really interesting idea. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, well, okay, so the theme is scholarship, right? Mm-hmm. So scholarship I know from experience takes time. So I've got this project here, this book that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I think the first, when it was an idea in the pub, I think from that moment until publication was probably 4 years, 5 years. It takes a lot of time. So if we have a center and you have a new director who walks in and says, yeah, now we're all going to do scholarship. If I'm a year and a half off retirement, oh, come on, what's the point? Why would I ask someone who's finishing their career to start thinking completely differently about something? That just doesn't make any sense, right? So, I mean, that's an extreme example. But then again, you could have someone who's 10 years off retirement who really hasn't thought in terms of scholarship. And this is more about having that conversation and saying, well, wait, does that mean you've never questioned anything you've done? And it's trying to get people to understand the concept of taking their questioning, taking their inquiry, and just taking it up a notch, making it just one step more formal than it was.
Let's think about that person who's a couple of years away from retirement a little bit more, because I think that we can link that sort of scenario back to two very important ideas we've already discussed. The notion that scholarship is collaborative. Mm. So you can start something, right? It doesn't preclude anybody else from taking it up to build upon what initially provide.
True.
And the other idea of ownership, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're open enough to understand that the whole intent of scholarship isn't just so that I can put my name onto something, right? Mm-hmm. Say authored by so-and-so, right? But that it has a sort of broader impact into teaching and learning, then that 60 two-year-old person can certainly at least begin on an avenue of scholarship.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I guess, you know, I wouldn't want to say that that person wouldn't be encouraged to.
Right.
But it's more the understanding that that person felt like this is just asking a bit much because I'm, you know, because the other way, the way you've just described it, this person who's a year and a half off retirement might suddenly get so excited that they get embark on something that they can full well continue doing once they no longer have to work, no longer have to teach, right? Why not? And then they can go and they can publish a book in their retirement if they like.
Right. But just to sort of make things clear, it isn't a scholarship isn't a obligation, right, at our center.
Is it an obligation? I don't know. It depends on how you define obligation. So the one thing we haven't talked about is the practice here of appraisal, right? An annual appraisal, which I'm not entirely comfortable with. It's not one. It's not the tradition I've come from. So it's been included in our center as one of the ways of indicating, yeah, what you've achieved within that system. So I guess you could cynically say, yeah, it's being. What was the word you used?
Obligation.
Obligation. Yeah. So I guess because I'm trying to put it in all the formal mechanisms. Because if we're asking people to engage with something, then we need to make sure that the formal mechanisms also support and represent that request.
Okay. So is the expectation that everybody should be engaged in some form of scholarship?
The expectation is that that's the default. That's the norm. That's the norm. But I don't think there's anything in a center that everyone does equally, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm comfortable saying, yeah, that's the expectation, but knowing that it's when you have something as a default expectation, there are always exceptions and there are always reasons why something isn't happening.
Mm. And a lot of the things that we do already should be grounded in scholarship.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, if we develop a course, there exactly. should be some sort of, you know, underpinning, something that we can, like, you know, argue about. This is the reason why we're doing this. These are the benefits.
Exactly.
Right. And support it. So it doesn't, like, again, we go back to sort of like just what we do as educators should be sort of supported by some degree of scholarship.
Exactly. And I'll give you another example because developing a course, I mean, that's a big endeavor, right, to write a whole course. But people all the time go to these CPD workshops and you go and you hear, or you hear about some new technology and you say, oh, I think I'm going to try that in my classroom. So scholarship is just saying, instead of trying it, why don't you try formalizing what you're doing a little bit and try to capture what it was like before you tried this new thing. And then see if you can capture what's happened since you did that new thing, just even for yourself. Was it worth doing or not? Scholarship.
I think that the word that you just used, formalizing, is interesting. Because I think a lot of things that we have been doing, we sort of do it with this intuitive sense that it would be beneficial to the students.
Hmm.
Right? We sort of have just, you know, based upon sort of our teaching training, where we went to graduate school, we have like this common, I shouldn't say common, because sometimes it's far too uncommon. We sort of have this intuition that, well, if we have this pedagogy of, you know, giving them some sort of input, giving them some way of practicing or executing whatever input we provided, and then sort of giving them feedback on what they produce, that intuitively makes sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it would be a much stronger argument, much stronger case, if we could make a formal argument.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly, yeah.
So I think that's a very interesting word choice that you made and that you used, and I think that it's something that, well, as teachers who often, you know, think like we focus on what we do in the classroom, that isn't distinct from scholarship.
Exactly. And can I tell you what's motivating me here?
Mm.
We all know that in our field or in academia, there's a theory practice divide, right?
Mm.
And having spent a fair amount of time on the theory side, on the researcher side, I'm bothered by that divide, and specifically I'm bothered by the untapped resource that's on the practice side. So there's this idea that researchers are coming up with very, very new ideas and researching, but actually I know from experience and I know from working myself and working with practitioners that practitioners are constantly coming up with new ideas as well. So researchers have a way of platforming their ideas, but practitioners don't. And so what I'm hoping is that if scholarship is much more a normal thing that starts to happen and gets out there, the extent to which researchers will be able to benefit themselves from that means a total advancement that we're now at the moment missing, I think.
Well, in addition to this really ambitious idea of scholarship, we've also begun transitioning into a competency-based assessment framework. Mm. Can you sort of give us a little bit of background on what this is?
On what this is. So competency. So competencies, it's just another way of thinking about ability and skill and knowledge. And to me, competency isn't some magic secret. It's just another way of thinking about what we're trying to achieve with our students. So in our own center, the idea of competency came out of discussions that were taking place across our center from our senior management, actually, not from me. And it made a lot of sense to use competencies as a way of thinking about what we're doing, mostly because we have such a large, complex curriculum. And I was having trouble seeing how that curriculum was joined up. What I saw was a collection of fantastic courses, but I was concerned about whether or not what was learned in course one was being followed up and reinforced in course two, and whether course three, four, and five were then introducing something else or beyond, or was there even a connection? So to me, competency allows us to do that.
All right. So Melinda, you mentioned this ability to sort of follow up. I wouldn't say necessarily skills, right? Because competencies are distinct from skills.
Of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Or perhaps just this this awareness and maybe the internalization of certain strategies. Mm. So I think how competencies might sort of shift the way we perceive the way we design courses is that I think our courses up until now were very skill focused, right? For instance, in any course's performance rubrics, there are discrete things that we look for, like eye contact, like gestures. Right, like the rhythm, the use of intonation, and those things are sort of like a one-off thing, right? On that day, maybe you perform really well. On that day, maybe for whatever reason, you don't perform as well as you normally do. Whereas with competencies, it's sort of something that can be tracked. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's something that is a little bit more permanent, I think, than just this one-off assessment. Certainly, the one-off assessment can be something that exhibits the degree to which you have acquired a competency. Mm. But it shouldn't be the end all.
Mm. Do you know, I think you're pointing at something that makes what we do difficult. And what we do difficult is we're trying to improve people's ability.
Right.
And how do you capture... Okay, so we're trying to improve people's ability, but then at the same time, we work within a system called higher education, which says you've got to capture... someone's ability, and you've got to report it in terms of a number or a letter grade.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like what you're doing is you're naming that conflict between having to quantify students' ability on a regular basis, at least one semester and at points within, right? Versus the reason we became teachers, which is to make people better at doing what they do, in our case, language and communication. Do you see what I mean? I don't know that it's really connected to competencies is what I'm trying to say.
Right. Or it may not be an effective measure of whether or not a competency is acquired, right? And what you just mentioned about how hard it is to sort of have a firm grasp of this idea of competency is shared, because from the Harvard Competencies Dictionary, they say that competencies are basically things that an individual must demonstrate to be effective. Right? Like, how do you get your hands around that idea, right? Things that an individual must exhibit to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in our courses, we ask them to be effective. We ask our students to be effective in many different ways, right? In many different scenarios. But I think one of the big benefits is the ability to, if we identify a principle that we hope to instill in a student in course one, that same principle can be extended in course two, in course three, in course four, and applied to increasingly more and more challenging situations, right? Whereas I think right now what we tend to do, and I'm only really, really familiar with a couple of courses that I teach a lot, okay, but I think what we tend to do is we're missing that connection between a course that is designed for a student to take first and then the extension of those abilities in the course, the follow-up course that they're that are designed to take second. All right.
Yeah. I guess the reason why I'm sort of taken in by this idea of competencies, I think it's important to note that what we're trying to do here is it's a competency framework. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that we're trying to capture and explicitly name at the curriculum level, not at the course level, at the curriculum level, as a way of then being able to connect up for the student where they're going from the first time they join us. So our center is quite privileged, actually, in just how many courses we're allowed to teach. Mm-hmm. So a lot of centers don't quite have this, right? So students here at UST have to take 4 credit-bearing courses in their time with us. So that's on average 1 English course a year. So if they're seeing us 4 times, and then they have to take Chinese, so 5 times in their 4 years, the question is, from their cumulative experience with us, do they actually improve across the board in their ability to communicate? And so the whole competencies idea is, can we abstract away from what you're doing in every lesson, in every course? Can we abstract away the things that we think we're helping our students to improve upon in a way that makes it clear to them and to us, makes it clear to them so that a first-year student and a final-year student, when they're leaving, they can actually see how they've improved in some measure, right? So they can see what they've done. What have they done with the 4 years they've spent with us, right? Yeah, so that's kind of the concept.
Well, but in order for us to get our students to that point, I think it's incumbent upon us to get them more engaged, right? Mm. Because some of the competencies touch on sort of engaging their willingness to learn on their own, which some might argue that's really not our role, right? Mm. I mean, you're a student at a highly competitive university in Hong Kong. Mm. Isn't it incumbent upon you to just sort of be self-motivated?
Do you know, I think, to me, the learning to learn is not about motivation. It's about recognizing the kind of world we live in. If I think about, I've been here 2 years. The amount that I've learned in 2 years is enormous, right? I've changed jobs. I've changed countries. And to me, the learning to learn is recognizing that you're not going to school so that you can do something that you then stop doing once you get that graduation ceremony hat, whatever. That it's so for us, for me, I don't know. I think we're probably, as educators, we should all be working on this learning to learn idea. I don't know. I think it's Tim Blackman, who's I think he's in the Open University. He's written quite a lot about this, about how it's, you know, we don't live in the information age anymore. We don't live in an age where you have to memorize lots of stuff. All the stuff is out there. We need to learn how to think about the stuff and to act on the stuff and to do useful good things with it. We need to learn how to, like, because it's we have to be able to adapt. So it's the competencies, it's the abilities that really matter now in all education, and then very much for us. I don't know, that's how I see it.
And I think this idea of designing courses that are more and more engaging for students might be something that influenced, I shouldn't say a decision, an option that we were given earlier in a meeting a month ago or so, this option of not requiring attendance.
Oh.
Right? Yeah, which, I mean, you know, in fairness, we're all very, very accustomed to requiring attendance, right, for a very long time. And there is, there's quite a few of us who think that, well, a lot of our students don't really take our courses seriously to begin with. Mm. If we eliminate that requirement of attendance, then aren't we sort of like operating on the back foot? Or right from the get-go?
I think there are two things here. I think the idealistic answer is we should be such great teachers, and we are great teachers. I mean, we're professionals, right? We work in an industry where other people teach without having any teaching qualification, right? Mm-hmm. So we should be able to engage students and to challenge them, no matter what we're teaching, that they want to come back for more. So that's the idealistic response. But I think on the other hand, we work at university level, and part of university is kids becoming grown-ups. And I think we're very well placed because we teach in small groups, because we make that personal connection to help students, help kids become grown-ups. And I make pragmatic decisions all the time. And if I'm facing some challenges, I step back and say, okay, I have X amount of time. Where do I put my time? What do I need to get where I'm going? And if the choice is I'm going to prioritize this other course over my language course, I think we have to respect students making that choice. but then they have to be responsible as well. So we have to respect it. And if they choose to make it to not show up and not do well, then they have to live with the transcript result as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to me, I'm comfortable with that. I don't see a problem there.
And again, you have given the course leaders an option, right, to include it or not include
Absolutely.
It. In a recent competencies mapping exercise, because just for the listeners, we didn't just decide on this willy-nilly. We actually did look at our courses and tried and had a draft of a competency framework. Mm. And then we took two of our courses, Language for Business Education, and we tried to map what we teach in those courses to the original draft of the competencies. And we noticed a few things. We noticed that there are a lot of competencies that we just expected the students to come in with, right? Like motivation. We just expect them to be motivated. Mm. The ability to give and receive feedback, right? But we also noticed that a lot of the competencies that we just expect of them and we don't explicitly teach, sometimes we assess them. Does there need to be a strong correlation between competencies that are assessed and competencies that are explicitly taught?
So, definitely. So the trouble with competencies is it's almost semantics. You can carve up the pie however you want, right? So we came up with 20 competencies in the CLE. Our universities decided to use competencies on its entire common core. And they have come up with, wait for it, 4. Okay. So now we're talking the language of competency and subcompetencies. And so really this whole competency idea, it is a concept. It's a notion. So the question of whether one should assess the competencies, I think it becomes lost in the logistics of what a course ends up being. Again, because we work in a system that has to have grades and that has to have, you know, reporting of some sort. But I guess to take your question for face value for what you meant. So I think definitely we have to, it's like saying, does an ILO, does an intended learning outcome have to be assessed? I think we have to be explicit about what we're teaching, and then we have to assess what we're teaching. Mm-hmm. And so this move to competencies is just reframing what we're teaching in a different way. And if we're going to say that this is what we're doing and we're going to make it explicit to students, then yes, we have to assess what we say we're teaching.
But in order to assess it, we have to have appropriate assessment rubric.
Correct.
That is a challenge.
Correct.
I mean, how do you write a rubric for, you know, excellent being able to, what was that Harvard competencies dictionary definition? Competencies are basically things that an individual must demonstrate to be effective. How do I judge a student to be excellent at that?
Do you know, it comes down to adjectives. So I'm serious. It comes down to, because we are actively working on this at the moment. And if you're familiar with the huge competency-based approach, the Common European Framework, CEFR, Framework of References for Languages, the acronym doesn't quite match what it means. But it's a series of can-do statements. So your Harvard definition has basically captured the idea of a can-do statement. And so if you take something like communicate effectively, then what you're doing at different levels is you're saying, can communicate somewhat effectively, can communicate very effectively, these are adverbs.
And adverbs.
Adjectives. Yeah, can communicate.
That's the director of our center.
Entirely appropriately, right? I'm serious. And that's what the rubrics end up doing. They just end up capturing levels of competency, right?
Right. Okay. It's exciting, right? Mm. It's certainly worthwhile, but there are definitely challenges to implementing these ideas. You worked at Leeds, right? We talked about that earlier. Did they have anything similar like that?
No, nothing similar, no. But the context is so totally different. Mm. So the context in most UK universities is, for the equivalent of what we do, is a pre-sessional, right? It's a pre-course, big, heavy summer dose. And then during the year, a kind of supporting, but credit-bearing like what we do is highly, highly unusual. Right. But this is an EMI, right? So the context is totally different.
Okay. Yeah. Do you see other institutions implementing similar ideas of scholarship, competencies?
Scholarship, yes. Competencies, no. No.
Interesting.
No. But I guess, I mean, what do you mean by, so in the UK, that there's all this talk about graduate attributes, right? There's not such a far cry from attributes to competencies. But no, this idea of putting in competencies as a to capture a curriculum, I don't know any other places doing it in the UK. But again, the context is very different.
Right.
So I don't know that it would fit. It wouldn't make a lot of sense
Right. It'd be interesting to sort of liaise with our colleagues in the other local universities to see if they're doing something similar.
That's right. And I know that other universities are talking about this.
Interesting.
Yeah, here.
Interesting. Okay, well, you certainly given us a lot to think about with respect to scholarship and competencies. Excellent. Well, just taking a look to the future, what do you see scholarship at our center in the future? Are you excited?
Yeah, partially because it's a large center. The reason I came here is when I visited at my interview, I just was so amazed at the quality of people here, and the idea of giving people a little bit of space and to see what they could do with it. I'm hugely excited to see what will happen.
Mm. And what about competencies? Do you envision any sort of competencies that you think might need to be added or maybe removed?
Oh, I'm sure we haven't got it right. Yeah. But, you just try things, right? And, because we're at the stage now of trying to figure out which courses should emphasize which competencies and how do you what level of competency do you require at the different levels? And, I'm sure we haven't got it right.
Right. But it's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress.
And it's a worthwhile work in progress.
Right? Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
One of the competencies that Melinda graciously encourages us, the teachers, to engage in is to take time off.
Absolutely.
Enjoy your weekends when you can.
Do you know, if you don't stop and recharge your batteries, you're just, the ability to go at what you're doing just starts to diminish. Yeah, so you've just really got to stop once in a while.
Okay, so how'd you recharge your battery this weekend?
I was out kayaking in the blistering sun. Yeah, but happily I was kayaking.
The question was, how did you recharge your batteries during the weekend?
That was recharging the brain battery, right? Because the body battery was going, ah!
Well, you had a good weekend, though, right?
Had a great weekend, yeah.
All right, we can all take a lesson from how to recharge our batteries by not kayaking in 35-degree heat. Again, our guest today, and we are really, really honored and thrilled, was Dr. Melinda Wong.
Thanks so much,
director, Levi. The director, the boss lady. Thank you so much for being here, Melinda.
Thanks again for joining us for this episode of Teachers Lift. As we round off our second year of producing these episodes, we're as grateful as ever for the support we've received from listeners and colleagues across Hong Kong and across the world. We're looking forward to producing fresh new content for you after the summer break. If you want to be sure to get notified when we start posting again, subscribe to The Lift from whatever podcasting app you use. This podcast is a collaborative production made by teachers at the Center for Language Education at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, the Center for Applied English Studies at the University of Hong Kong, and the English Language Center at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. We appreciate when you can like and subscribe and follow us on Facebook or any other social media sites where we post. This really helps us get the word out. This episode was produced by me, Patrick Deloge, with the kind assistance during the capture phase from our colleagues over at the technical team at CLE. Thanks, guys. I appreciate the help. Thanks to everyone for listening. The Teacher's Lift will be back in September. Until then, have a relaxing summer. Bye now.